Okay, we're going to finish this again today, one way or the other, okay? So, let us remind ourselves where we are for the 10th time. So, the Gemara tells us that, A, memashkinela staka, that you can take collateral to force people to give staka. Two, rava force or nothing baimi to give staka. Problem, the Gemara in Chulin Daf Kuf Yud says that you are not allowed to coerce for mitzvot shematam schar bitzida, where the reward is delineated in the parsha. Tzedakah seems to fit that bill because the end of it says it'll be good for you if you give tzedakah. Three types of answers that we have. Those that reject that we're dealing with coercion, those that reject that tzedakah is defined as matam schar bitzida, and those who believe really it is, but this is exceptional for one of many reasons. So, to go through the answers that we saw. Rabbeinu Tam, answer one. This is not kfiyah. It's just, it's stern rebuke, right? And that is not coercion. Problem with Rabbeinu Tam is that works for the second half. It's hard to say that monetary coercion is not coercion. So either you say it's reversible, or you say that in the case of Pikuach Nevesh, you can do it, otherwise you can, which is some achronim, fine. Second answer in Tosvos, which belongs to category three, type answers, which is, in this particular case, they agreed to be coerced. Answer three is the re, which is, no, this assay is different because it has two los assays to bolster it. So, again, category three, it's an exception, but one of two understandings. Either we're coercing to not violate the lav, or the lavim transformed the assay into a super assay, and that's why they can be coerced. Yes, Ezra. So, you're right, but maybe they don't have to, or maybe they shouldn't be using their power when it's not necessary.
Right, but I feel like this is a case where it is for a good.
Well, not necessarily. Not if the Torah says that this is the type of thing that God says I'll take care of. So then you're overstepping your bounds. But yeah, but they don't do it for no reason. That's the thing, is they need warrant. And if the Torah says in this particular, if they have a rule that they're not warranted in these cases, so that's a rule, I guess. Okay, that's one, two, three. The Ritva we saw goes in the direction of saying, look, this whole sugya is different. Yes, it's mitzvah says, yes, this is actual kriya, but this is exceptional because any limitation that you know are only for mitzvah which stem from deontological or virtue ethics or something like that or whatever, but not those that are consequentialist in nature, where the focus, though not the exclusive, but the focus is the result, is that the poor get money, and therefore this is an exception to the rule. Now, part of the reason on the, once we introduced the Ritva, we said that clarifies perhaps Rabbeinu Tam. And the other is that maybe the reason that they assume that fundamentally, philosophically, you don't coerce for tzedakah is because they disagree with this assessment, and they say that the mitzvah is more about tovat halev, it's about being nice, and the like. Then we had Gavi or Lichtenstein, and the truth is it's also the first answer in the Minchas Chinuch, who says, look, tzedakah has two parts. There is the giving of the money, and then there's the giving of the money not begrudgingly. There's the emotional component. And the promise of good is only on the emotional component, not on the actual giving of the money. And that's why forcing someone to give the money is not matan schar bitzida. The emotional component is, but look, we're not trying to force you to want to give, we're just forcing you to give the money. And again, here you might see the distinction where the actual giving of the money is consequence-based, and the emotional component is virtue or deontology or something like that. So that was answer five? Those are five answers? Yes? Then we saw the Rei Soloveitchik, which was answer six, which was Ellie's answer from yesterday, which is, no. Staka is about virtue, meaning personal stucco, but that's because there are other mitzvot that are result-oriented. And you could say that as taxes, or as the Rav put it, and Eli put it, which is, no, the mitzvah of stucco l'rabim, right? Communal stucco, which is result-oriented, so that's coercible, but the personal involvement is not. And here we're dealing with the community. We're dealing about kupa, we're dealing with tamchoi, we're dealing with all of those things, and that is coercible because it is result-oriented. That's six answers. A seventh answer, which we did not see, and I'm not going to make you look at inside, but since we're finishing up today, I'll throw it out there, is the second answer in Minchas Chinuch, which is simply, look, Saka is mentioned multiple times in the Torah. Only in one of them is the Schar written next to it. And since, on balance, most of the times that Saka appears, it's not Matan Schar Betida, so you can coerce normal. Okay? Not much to say on that. I mean, we can try to figure out his conceptualization of why is it that it being written next to one pasuk doesn't shed light on all the pasukim, but I don't want to get bogged down in that. I want to deal with the last two answers that I had originally given you, and then call it a day. Considering I thought we might do this in one day, we're going to take three, you know. Rosenzweig would, like, apologize at the beginning of every year. He's like, I really thought I was going to be done yesterday. I really thought I was going to, we do this for, like, weeks at a time. Now I feel very sympathetic. Like, all the times I was frustrated, I mochel him. You know, not that he needed my mochila, but I now understand him. Fine. So we have two answers left. The Ritzba and the Ktsot. Okay? So let us start with the Ritzba so that we can polish off Tosfot. Adam, introduce us to the Ritzba Baal HaTosfot. Very good. Rav Yitzchak ben Avraham. Very good. When does he live? Okay, very good. Second half 12th, beginning of 13th, yep. He lived in France and he traveled, and his brother was? Good. The other Rajba. So sometimes you'll see the Rajba in Tosfot. The Rajba in Tosfot is not the person we call the Rajba. Rav Shimon ben Aderet, it is Rav Shimon bar Avram, the brother of the Ritzba. These are two brother Balei Tosfot. They like traveling. Thank you. Thank you, Adam. One day you'll know all the Balei Tosfot, all 150 of them. No. No, I have a book at home, a two-volume book at home when I need to look it up. Called Baalei HaTosfot by Urbach. Yes. Yes. The three most important Baalei HaTosfot are Rabbeinu Tam, who's the father of the dialectic, right? Whose name is Rabbeinu Yaakov, right? The Ri, who was basically the organizer, right? Really, the two main ones are the Ri and Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam is the Mechadesh. He introduces. He's the father of this dialectical approach of the Baalei HaTosfot. The Ri is the organizer, is the one who systematized it and makes sure that it, you know, sort of penetrates all of Talmud Torah. Then the Rosh Mishantz is arguably also right up there in the top three. Also great organizer, but he writes on Mishnah. So we have him on Zraim, on Kudshim, on Tarot. So expands the, that, you know, we have, like, if you want to go top 10, right, you have the Rashbam, right, who takes the place of Rashi in many Masechtot and also writes a commentary on Torah. You have the earlier Baalei Tosfot, Rabbi Meir, right, like the sons-in-law of Rashi, before you get to the grandkids, which are the most of them. In Germany, these are all French, right? The Germans, so some of the most important are the Urza Ruah, right, Rav Yitzchak of Vienna, Ravya, Ravan, in Tosfot, the other ones you'll have. You have people who come up a lot, you know, Ritzba, Rajba, Riva come up fairly frequently. Rabbi Yosef Tuv Elem comes up once in a while. You have like random ones. You have like one in Switzerland, the Ram Mitzurich, of Zurich, Moshe of Zurich. Yeah, you have all types of interesting people. Myron Rittenberg is the last major Balatesman in Germany. His Rebbe is a sort of interesting person, Ezra of Mankantor. No one knows about him. You have the Beit Midrash in Evro. So you have three or four major Balei Tosfot in Evro. Good luck trying to spell Evro. It's really, Evro is E-V-R-E-A-U-X. So, Evro, what?
It was the Maram, the one that was kidnapped in the
Yeah, that one. Yes, and namesake of my oldest son. The Rosh. Shimshon of Sens. Who so was? Yeah, there's more than one from Sens, yeah. No, the Rashba is the Rosh Mishans. Right? He's Bar Avram, Rav Shimshon of Sens. Yes. The Rashba is the Rosh Mishans. Yes. Same person. It's not an accident. Yes. He's sometimes known as the Rosh Mishans because he's from Shans. Sometimes in Tosfos it'll be the Rashba because he's Rav Shimshon ben Avram. Yeah. Fine. So, and in general, the Balei Tosfos in France write more chidushim, the Balei Tosfos in Germany write more halachic codes. Okay. Anyways, the Ritzbah. So what does the Ritzbah say? Finally, the fourth answer in Tosfos. Ezra.
When it says that, for the
Very good. So the Ritzbah, based on the way he understands the Yerushalmi, takes our entire sugya and throws it upside down. And he says, until now, you've assumed that there is those things which you must coerce for and those things which you may not coerce for. And those are the only two possibilities. But the Ritzbah says that's not how things work. In fact, you are allowed to coerce for whatever you want, always. The question isn't, what are you allowed to coerce for? The question is, if you don't coerce, right? If you don't ensure the fulfillment of mitzvot via coercion, will God smite you down? And the answer is, for all things you are allowed to coerce, things that are matzon schar b'tzida, because God said that he will deal with it, if you don't do it, you will not be smitten by God, but you should indeed, you can choose to coerce if you want to. So let me just, I will read the Yerushalmi for you for a minute upon which he's based. I sent that out, I know, at some point. Ktiv, Moz Neit Tzedek, Av Neit Tzedek. The Pasuk says you must have fair weights and measures. Mikan amru chachamim kol mitzvah shematam schara b'tzidayin beit din muzharin aleo. So here, God promises reward. So this was where Chazal said that Bezdin is not muzhar on things which have their reward next to them. Yishyeh lecha mana lecha anar garmus. Alkach v'temer hachein. He said, but wait a second. The Beis Din does indeed have people who go around and enforce that the weights and measures weigh what they should. So if you think that you're not allowed to coerce, so then how can they do that? So Amar Rabbi Bon Bar Chia, Keine Matnitin, Kol Mitzvah Shematan Schara B'Tzida, Ein Beis Din Ne'enashin Aleha. Anything which has its reward next to it, the Beit Din is not punished for it. And the way the Ritzbah understands this is that you are always allowed to coerce. The only question that the Gemara was worried about is, do you have to? And if you don't, is God going to be angry? And the answer is, no. When Mazon Schar B'Tzida, you're allowed, if you so choose, to leave it up to God to enforce the mitzvah, but if you don't, if you choose to take it on your shoulders, then kol hakavod lachem, and that's what they do by weights and measures, and that's what Rava was doing when he forced the person to give tzedakah. Yes, Ezra, why are you angry?
For the fair weights and measures, isn't there like, I mean, what, I guess it would be, what,
Correct. But the Rishonim doesn't believe that. But you're right. For the in the Bavli, right, which doesn't bring this answer, you could have all types of things. You could say that, like the Ritva, that having fair weights and measures is consequentialist because people will lose that money. You could say, like the Rishonim, that there was also Lavim attached to it. Yeah, meaning you could, right, within the context of the Bavli, you could defend it anyway. The Ritva assumes that Rishonim, okay, this is probably a good time to say this. The Yerushalmi, this should be obvious, but it really isn't. The Yerushalmi and the Bavli are two different traditions. Therefore, the Yerushalmi does not have to agree with the Bavli. Sometimes Rishonim will read the Bavli in light of the Yerushalmi or read the Yerushalmi in light of the Bavli, but you don't have to. And therefore, in this case, you see that the Ritzbah is reading the Bavli in light of the Yerushalmi. The other Rishonim don't tell you. Either they believe that the Yerushalmi means something else. I don't know what they think it means, but it means something else. Or they think that the Bavli just disagrees with the Yerushalmi on this point, right? So that leaves you open to, right, mixing and matching, right? Okay. Now, I will point out that within the Yerushalmi, there are really two different ways of reading it. So when you say that if you don't coerce, you won't be punished, so what might that mean? There are two things it could mean. Either you should, but if you don't, you won't be punished. Or that you don't have to at all, you just have the option, right? Those are two different formulations. Which one does the Ritzbah seem to believe? The Ritzbah. No, wait, before you get to Svara, which the Ritzbah, I'm not sure. It seems that, I think the Ritzbah thinks that it's optional, I think.
Like, if you say that you should, I mean, in both ways, but even more so if you say you should, why would the case of the person not respecting the parent, why would him being about to work?
Correct. So if you say it's Tully Bird Sonam, so then that Gemara makes sense. Right? If you say that, no, you really have to do it, you're just not punished, it's a hard read in the Bavli.
I think both ways are hard,
one way. Yeah, I agree with you, right? Both ways are hard. It happens to be that this question is a machlokes Ritva and Rashba within the Yerushalmi. The Rashba says that what it means is it's totally optional, right? Im lo ratzu beit din lachof ein kofin. If they don't want to force, they don't have to. Aval vaday im ratzu lachof kofin. But if they want to, they can. The Ritva, the one I gave you on Rosh Hashanah Davav, how does he understand the Yerushalmi? That you should, but you're not punished. Very good. I said these are two possibilities. The Raja says one, the Ritva says the other. I would hope that process of elimination that you would be able to do that. Yes. So the truth is that the Yerushalmi, the Rashba, thinks that it's totally volitional, and the Ritva says, no, you really should do it, you're just not punished if you don't. These are both admittedly hard reads in the Bavli, right? Which is why I think most Rishonim don't love it. However, you should, as much as I think this is a hard-ish read in the in the Bavli, the Ramah actually paskins like this understanding of the Yerushalmi according to the Rashba. Okay? So the Ramah, meaning standard Ashkenazi Pesach, actually follows the Rashba's understanding of Yerushalmi, and he writes, Mitzvah Rashavara Avot U'mitzvah Aseh Shematan Schara Katuv Bitzida V'lochein Ein Beidin Shalmata Mechuyavin Lachof Aleah. Aval imrotim lachofer should be adam. But the Rama paskins that When it's Matan Schar B'tzida, you really can do whatever you want. You can coerce, but you don't have to. So he paskins like the Rashba's understanding of the Yerushalmi. Now, several others point out, right, that Tosfot seems to take the position of the Rashba, right? Tosfot seems to believe like the Rashba, that it's completely optional. Right, it does sound that way. What? The Rizba, yeah, right? Meaning he says... so if you look at the Rizba, right, let's read it inside. The Rizba says, the Rizba near a Hadein Beitin Muzharin. One second. Al mitzvah asay shematan sara bitzida. Hainu dein enoshin. Means you don't get punished. Rechen mashu rabbi yushal memokar esfina. Kol basar lo imokar avua v'kaftu. Actually, no, the law of a moker abu of a kaftu, and then he quotes the Gemara in Chulin about the person who didn't honor his father. Amalu shavku ha'chi peirusho incha muzharim la'chricho achi yazik shar mitzvah asay. You don't have to worry about it. You're not muzhar on it. Right? I mean, at first it sounds like you're not punished, but then he says you're not muzhar on it, which makes it sound like you're not obligated in it. Right? You don't need to coerce him, Amar Le'azin, Tzuk of Lulavein, Ose, Makin, Adatajin, Nasuk, Adamra, Bako, Dave. Right? So it sounds like the Rizba takes the Rajba's position because he used that language in Muzharin, right? You're not warned about it, right? Which makes it sound, right? I mean, according to the Rizba, you are obligated to coerce. You're just not punished if you don't do it, right? The Rizba, like the Rajba, says you're not Muzhar on it. Yeah. Yes, I tend to think that the Rizba agrees with the Rashba here. Now it could also be that there is another nuanced way of reading the Rizba, which is that he thinks you always coerce, you just don't coerce as much, right? That the problem in Chulin wasn't that they were coercing at all, it was that they kept beating him, within an inch of his life. And he was saying, look, because it's a Matan Schar B'tzida, you should put in a little bit of effort, but you don't have to put in too much effort and beat him that much.
Could you say that there's only there's no obligation on the state to convert, but there's always a possibility, and the only time when you would say that possibility should be like that possibility of the agent of course should be used is when the consequentialism or whatever lines up. So in the case of Zucca,
correct, right? I think you're right, right? I think that we could combine things, right? That we could say, look, what he'll say is you're not obligated to do it, but you're allowed to and maybe even should. And in the case when the mitzvah in question also has consequentialist components to it, so then it's the right thing to do, right? It's the preferred thing to do. Now, there are different types of models, but let's go for non-consequentialist, virtue-based or deontological-based or whatever. Yeah, that it might be on the attitude, and it might be right on. But I agree with Ezra, right, that you could come up with a good hybrid position, which is to say that, look, what the Rizbah will tell you is any time that you matan skar b'tzida, you don't have to coerce, but you're allowed to, right? That seems to be what he holds. But the question of whether you allow it's totally neutral or you're allowed to and it's better to avail yourself of the option of coercion or not, that type of cheshbon may be based on whether the mitzvah in question is more consequences-based. Because, and that's why by kibud av v'aim, they would say, better not to, right? Or at best, coerce minimally. And by tzedakah, they'll say, it's best to take advantage of your rights and maybe even quasi-responsibilities to coerce. Yeah, I agree with that, which would bring us back to the discussion yesterday. Okay. Fine. Are we good on the Rizbah? Yeah? Okay, the Rizbah did flesh it out a little bit. But I feel like I want to make sure we at least see the ktos, so that we don't spend yet another day on it. So let's try to get the last position out there and then we'll be done. Okay. For the ktos. Ezra, I turn to you. Ezra said to me yesterday or 2 days ago, and he said, wait a second. We argued that, I think it was yesterday, that the Ritvah is consequentialist, right? That the Ritvah says the reason that you coerce by tzedakah is because machzoram shel aniyim, that tzedakah of all mitzvot is based on the results, and therefore it's worth coercing so that the poor people will get their money. But Ezra correctly pointed out that I was not being fair to the Ritvah. Why was I not being fair to the Ritvah, Ezra? Very good. Right, because Ezra said, but wait a second, if you think that tzedakah is purely consequentialist, so then you shouldn't coerce someone to give tzedakah, you should just take their money and give it to the poor. Right? A court-endorsed Robin Hood, right? Not really, because by definition, not. The whole point of Robin Hood was that it was stealing from the, you know, rich and giving to the poor, which is not endorsed in any halachic control of this. What? Then it would not be, yes, you can't be a vigilante if the court says do it, yes. Yes, it's not vigilanteism. Right, we know that, right? That's the old thing. That what? Oh, the 400 witches. Yeah. Well, that was court. No, that was extrajudicial punishment by the court. That's an interesting question, but let's not go down that rabbit hole now. It's a fascinating figure, but let's not go through it. Ella, yes. Yeah, no, I think Elliot, that's exactly what Ezra's point was that the Ritvah isn't fully consequentialist. He says tzedakah has a strong consequentialist element, and that's why we would coerce. But it's still a mitzvah, and in every mitzvah, the benefit of kfiyah over straight confiscation of property is that if we coerce you, you will at least do the mitzvah, which, from a deontological perspective, at least you performed it. Yes, it would not qualify Kant's high level of you must have pure intent because you're being beaten. Fine. But the fact that there's inherent value to doing the right thing, we could go in different models. We could call it divine command theory, right? That you performing the act is important because it shows submission to God. Whatever you want. Or you could say, look, enough times the court forces you to give tzedakah, it'll eventually change your virtue and make you a good person. Yeah, I think the Ritvah is telling you that tzedakah is primarily consequentialist, but not entirely, and that's why we don't just confiscate property, but it encourages us to coerce you to give the money. That was Ezra's point and Ellie's point. Now, I think you're 100% right. Yes, Ezra. Do you want to add something? This was your point. Did you have something you wanted to add to your point? Okay. So Eli and Ezra are correct, right? 100% correct, that the Ritva, for as much as he justifies his theory of coercion on the notion that it's consequentialist, he doesn't mean that exclusively. Clearly, because he doesn't just say confiscate the property, he says coerce the person to ensure that he gives the money, the poor people get it, but he still wants the person involved. Again, is that because of virtue? Is it because of deontology? Is it because of divine command? I don't know. Okay? The Sharon didn't write in this language. But you can imagine that in some way he thinks the act of performing the mitzvah, even under coercion, is valuable. For whatever ethical, moral, religious theory he's justifying it, he has a hybrid theory for tzedaka. Okay. But, and now we get to the final position. Who does not have a hybrid position at all? Yes, that's who we're left with. We're left with the Kstos. Yes, I know you're thinking. Who is left? Is the Kstos. Process of elimination. Yes. So, let us remember the Kstos' name. Let's see if you remember from yesterday what's his name. Aryeh Leib Heller. And the Kstos, and this is, I said at the beginning that we had eight answers. Is this number eight? Let's see, wait, Rabbeinu Tam 1, Rabbeinu Tam 2, Ri and Ritzvah, that's 4 in Tosfot, the Ritzvah's consequentialism, Gabi or Lachem Tingman Cheschenuch, that it's the emotional component is what you get the scar for, the Minchas Chenuch number 2 that I added, which is that not everywhere in the Torah is Tzaka Matan Tzar B'Tzi, the Rav community versus private, so this is answer 9. I'm sorry, 9 answers. There are 9 answers, at least, that I know of, okay? So this is answer 9. What, Gavi? What? It's only 9 answers. What's the problem? First of all, I would like to point out that I didn't, and I think this is important, I didn't just say there are 9 answers. We have tried to conceptualize them into 3 categories, right, where we pointed out these aren't, right, this is, by the way, an important methodological point. Yes, there are 9 answers, right, and maybe you didn't predict all of them, but when you approach the sugya, we all pretty much figured out that there are 3 types of answers. There isn't 9, right, 3 types of answers, each with various possibilities within them. That's important, because it's easier to remember when you realize that these are 3 categories of answers, and then there are variations, rather than just these are 9 things, right? Because there are certain common methodological conceptual moves that are made by different answers. And this isn't 9 random answers, right? All the answers at the end of the day are either explaining why this isn't kfiya, why tzedakah is not matan tzar b'tzidah, or why despite the fact that it's matan tzar b'tzidah, you're allowed to coerce, right? They do that in different ways, right? By dividing tzedakah into personal versus private, or the emotional component versus the actual giving of the money, or whatever, right? But in the end of the day, it's 3 possibilities which break down into a total of at least 9. I expect you to remember all of them, right? You know, if I wake you up in the middle of the night, this was like Rabbi Carrigan's thing when I was in yeshiva. This is how he loved saying it, right? Is that, you know, Rabbi Friedman said it when I was in high school about certain things, right? There were certain things he said, this is so important that I want you to know it well enough that if someone would shake you awake in the middle of the night, that you would, that, and said, what does, you know, whatever. His example was the Nekuda Nifla, right? If someone shakes you in the middle of the night and says, what is the Nekuda Nifla? I want you to know it. I'll tell you in a second. And then, right, Carrigan just did it with everything, right? That, like, you know, right, like, that's how well you have to know things, at least the basics of a sugya. What is the Nekuda Nifla? Gevalt. The Nekuda Nifla is one of those times when the Rambam comes out of his shell and actually does fancy shmancy lumdus. So in the 3rd parak of Krisos, in the Parash Mishnayos, the Rambam asks, there's a rule of Ein Isser Chalal Isser, right? That once you have an Isser, another Isser cannot fall on it, with 3 exceptions. Isser Mosif, Isser Kolel, and Bam Bevas Achas, right? Which is, if the new Isser adds a dimension, right, so it used to be an Isser Lav, and now it's an Isser Karet, or it expands the number of people who are involved. So before the woman was an Almana L'Kohen Gadol, so she was forbidden to Kohen Gadol, then she got remarried, now she's Eshet Ish, right, so now everyone's forbidden to her, right? Or simply the two Yisurim come at the same time, and therefore it's not one coming first and the other being prevented from descending. Is Bam Varacha. Those are the three exceptions. So the Rambam asks, if that's the case, why is it that according to the Rambam, Basar Bechalav, you don't violate Basar Bechalav if you have pig and milk. If you have pig and milk, it's just the Yisur of pig, and therefore it's Asur Ba'achila, but not Hana'ah. Right? Because non-kosher food, non-kosher animals are forbidden to eat, but you're allowed to benefit. But Basar Bechalav, you can't benefit. The Nafka Mina being, but the Nafka Mina is feeding your animal, is that you can't feed your animal a cheeseburger. But according to the Rambam, you are allowed to feed your animal a pig cheeseburger because it's only, because you're allowed to feed your animal not kosher food. You can't treat them Basar Bechalav. That's why Reganak once told me that someone, a dog food company wanted to get a hechsher. And so they called the OU and they said, you know, we really want to get a hechsher. Can we, we're willing to switch our product from pig to cow and, you know, whatever. And he said, look, I'm not giving you a hechsher. But he, like, looked at the ingredients. He's like, please, 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 please leave it as pig. It'll be more kosher with pig than cow because there was milk in it. And they were like, wait, you're telling me as a kosher organization that we should leave the pig in? He's like, yes, please leave the pig in. If you leave the pig in, then at least according to the Rambam, and Zagel Meirvava Paskins that way, then you can feed it to people's dogs. But if you make it with cow, so then it's a machloket and it may be, you know, yeah. No, I'm sorry. I misstated that. Everyone agrees that pig and milk is not. The question is about nevela, right? Is about meat which is kosher just wasn't shechted, an animal which is kosher. Anyway, but the Rambam asks, why is it that basar bechalav, when you have non-kosher meat, the isur does not take effect, but if you're makdish, right, if you're makdish, not kosher meat, it would take effect. And he said, what's the difference? Both basar bechalav and hekdish add isur hana'ah to what before was only an isur achila. Shouldn't they both, therefore, have the rule of ein isur chal isur? So why is it by basar bechalav, even though basar bechalav adds an isur hana'ah, it remains, right, when you use non-kosher meat for basar bechalav, it does not become asur b'hana'ah, right, because the isur doesn't take effect. Why not? You're adding a dimension. So the Rambam answer is no, because kudshim, hekdish, the isur is fundamentally an isur hana'ah, and therefore it's considered adding a dimension so it can be added. But by basar bechalav, even though it's asur b'hana'ah, it's not really an isur hana'ah. It's an Isra Hana'ah, which is conceptually an expanded Isra Achila. And therefore, even though it looks like an Isra Hana'ah, it's not. It's an expanded Isra Achila, and that can't descend on the non-kosher meat. Right? That's the Rambam's Nukuja Nifla. Okay? It's very nice, Lumdus. You know, I might have mentioned, I think, to Gavi, that this actually happened to me once. Right? That I literally was woken up. But I told you, don't feel bad if you fall asleep in shir, because it happened to me many times. So, which is not surprising considering my sleep schedule. So when I was in Rosenzweig Shir once, and we were doing this sugya, I was nodding off in shir. And you know how sometimes when you guys are a little bit distracted, I meanly call on you to get you back? So Rosenzweig did the same thing to me. I was clearly nodding off, so he called on me, and he's like, Jonathan, what is the Nikud Nifla? But I had been prepared since high school that if someone were to wake me up in the middle of the night and ask what the Nikud Nifla is, I should be ready to say it. And that woke me up out of my sleep. I don't even know if I opened my eyes, but it was like reflex since high school. And I, exactly what I just said. I said, the Nikud Nifla is the Rambam's Beirus of the third parak of Krisos, where he says that even though Bal Isur Hana'ah and Basar Bechalav look like Kudshim and Basar Bechalav look like Isur Hana'ah, one of them is conceptually defined as Isur Hana'ah, and therefore Isur Motiv because it adds a dimension, but Basar Bechalav is conceptually an expanded Isur Achila, and he's like, oh, correct. And I'm like, yes, when I freed from in high school, see, it looked like I was sleeping. I was, but you don't know that I was prepared for this since I was 17. For the day that someone, because you know, in high school, it was like, what are the chances someone's going to wake me up and ask me to fly? And the answer is, it happened. So, you know, now you're prepared for, I don't know when, but one day someone will just shake you in the middle of the night and ask you, I don't know what took you. Yes, they will wake Ellie up in the middle of the night and say, what does the ksot say on the issue of kfiya by tzedakah? Fine. But it was like I had waited, you know, I had waited years for the possibility that would ever happen. And then it happened. I was very, you know, I was also very relieved because I assumed that Rosenzweig just assumed that I wasn't sleeping in shir, right, because I got it right. But, you know, it wasn't true. It was just one of those things that I'm capable of saying in my sleep. Pshuto kimashma'o. Good times. Good times. No, unless you want me to start calling you every day at 2 in the morning. Every time I'm woken up by my twins in the middle of the night, I will just call Gavi and say, so, what did we say in the Sugya of Gardumen? Right? Yeah. Even awake, I'm not sure I know what Gardumen, you know. I taught it. I'm not sure I could, you know. Okay. What? What? They're wonderful. Okay. So the final sheet that always looks so. The Ksod is picking up on the Rambam, where the Rambam had said, Ezra, that Misha Nishtateh, what's Nishtateh? One who goes crazy and therefore is no longer chayav in mitzvot. Own it charesh, or he becomes a deaf mute, which in halacha means, right, meaning he also is not a ben dat. I'm going to bracket for now the question of whether in modern times a deaf mute is considered not a bar dat, because, and whether deaf mute is a formal category of someone who can't hear, or it's a substantive category of someone who can't communicate. It's a three-way machloket aposkim, right? Whether it's a formal category, and therefore even nowadays someone who can't hear and speak is considered not a bardat. It's completely substantive, which is it's just about communication, and if the person can communicate and indicate that they have full mental capacity, then they are bardat. Or a middle category, which is ramosha, which is as long as they can hear in any way, shape, or form, right? Even if it's not like, you know, in any way that's effective, but you can combine the fact that they can hear with the fact that they can communicate to make it that they are bardat. It's an interesting sugya. But if someone goes crazy or becomes a chirej, beidin poskin alav sakam haya ra'ui, the Rambam paskins, that Bezdin just takes the money from their property, right? What we call yored l'nechasav. They go down into the property and they take the money, they extract it for the poor. Okay? Now the Kesef Mishnah justified the position of the Rambam how? The Kesef Mishnah simply says that the reason the Rambam thinks that they take the money is because of an assumption that that's what the guy would have wanted. Yeah, the Efshar Lomar Shetam Rabbeinu, which in the Mishnah called them Nichalim, have it stuck on me, Mamonei. Probably the guy wanted his money to be used for staka, the gam ki mamonash al the meshubat lasod minu staka, shalach min nayam min poskin staka min eichu ozit staka b'chomoka b'shu. And that's why the Kesef Mishnah distinguishes between someone who is no longer mentally fit and someone who traveled, right? Because the Kesef Mishnah says it's completely based on what we assume the guy wanted. If the guy is traveling, so we can't assume that he wants you to take from his property here for staka because, very simply, what? Because he? And he might be giving tzedakah wherever he is. Right? If you have someone who's fully mentally capable, he just is traveling, so you don't take from his money here, because for all you know, he's going on a philanthropic journey, and he's, you know, giving away his money to malaria nets, because he's decided that consequentialists speak, right, in terms of utility, buying malaria nets is the most effective stock in the world, right? As we know, we've already discussed this. $1 saves 10 lives or something. You can Google it, this consequentialist utilitarian website that just ranks things by utility. It's like, anyways. But, So because the Mishnah says, don't derive anything from the Rambam. All the Rambam wants to tell you is that it's based on your dot. What did you probably want? But what does the Ketot say? The Ketot says, basically what Ezra has said on and off several times over the last few days, which is, no, Staka is entirely consequenceless. And not just that, but we've seen in previous figures that it's so consequentialist that how do we conceptualize Staka? As if it already belongs to the poor people. I think Ezra said this on day one, didn't you? I think it was Ezra said it on day one. I'm not sure. I think it was Ezra. Ezra can take credit for it because no one else is taking credit for it. Right? Which is, Staka is not just a mitzvah. It's so consequentialist. It's so about the result that the poor people have a claim on that money already. Right, the poor, as long as you know how much they should get and how much this person should give, the poor people already have a claim. And the reason you can be kofa has nothing to do with the mitzvah. It's because part of tzedakah isn't just mitzvah, it's formal legal obligations that are created, a debt that is created from the people who have to the have-nots. And therefore, the Ketot said, the reason you can coerce, even with someone who's no longer chayev in mitzvot, and this is where the Ketot diverges from the Ritva, right? Because the Ritva, as Eli and Ezra both correctly noted, says tzedakah is mostly consequentialist, but it's still a mitzvah. And therefore, we don't just take the money away, we coerce you to perform the mitzvah. But the Rambam's case doesn't work that way because you're dealing with people who are not chayev in mitzvot. Right? They're not a bar dat. It's not that they're incapable. They're not chayev in mitzvot anymore. So if you thought that it was a consequentialist mitzvah, but it's still, in the end of the day, the coercion is about the mitzvah, so then you have to coerce them. You can't just take the property. And therefore, someone who's not chayev in mitzvot, you can't take it. But if you think, no, part of tzedakah isn't just the mitzvah, but that it's so about the result that it creates a debt, it creates a monetary obligation from the haves to the have-nots, so then you might even be able to coerce, even with someone who's not having mitzvah, because it's not what you're coercing for is not the mitzvah component, it's the debt component, right? It's that result-oriented monetary obligation that's created that's independent of the spiritual value of giving it to them. Yes, Ezra. Okay, let's read the Ketot. This is the Ketot in a nutshell, but now let's read it. So he says, "Bitstaka nira lefia nad lefia nira nira lefia niu dati k'divrei hakesef mishnah." He says, "I think the Kesef Mishnah is right, but this is how he takes it. Kevan diktiva b'Torah mitzvat staka. Since the Torah tells you staka, harei kemo mitzvat ha'anaka." It's like the mitzvah of Ha'anaka. What's the mitzvah of Ha'anaka? Ha'anik, ta'anik, lo. He's going to cry. What is the mitzvah of Ha'anaka? That when your slave goes free, you must give them monetary parting gifts to help them get back on their feet and not, you know, end up in their own... in their old ways, right? Basically, right, if someone was impoverished and ended up stealing or had to sell himself out of poverty, if after 6 years you don't give him any money to start his new life, he's going to be right back where he was 6 years ago. And therefore, there's a mitzvah d'oraita called ha'anaka, ha'anek ta'aniklo, give him a parting gift. So the Ketot said that's also a mitzvah, but clearly there, it's more than just a mitzvah, it's a chov, it's a monetary obligation. D'yesh mo mishum shi'abud nichsei umamono mishubad l'tein la'ayim. In addition to the mitzvah, it's so much result-oriented, there's actually a shibud nichasim. There's a monetary obligation that inheres in the property of the haves. V'hadin yordan l'nichasav kishalach l'minayam. So why don't you do that when he's traveling? Why don't you take his property when he's traveling? Because of Kesef Mishnah. Because he's giving staka wherever he is. So he... It's not that any specific poor person has a right to any specific money. It's that the have-nots have a certain amount of claim in the property of the haves. But if the guy might be giving somewhere else, so he's doing it already.
And
And this is his answer to Tosfot. Answer 9. Bahadamin and Parakavat Kama Debava Batra the R Tosfot Akve Rabbi Ami Litzdaka. Deha Amru Kol Mitzvah Shematan Schara Bitsido Ein Beit Din Kofin Aleha. Didn't we say that you aren't allowed to coerce? The Ayin Sham, look there. Ukvar Nitkashu Bo Kol Arishonim. All the Rishonim had all their answers. We know, we've seen 8 answers already. Okay? Lefi Mashikatavnu, but based on what I've said, the Bitstaka, it be Shibud Nichse Litain Mamono Litstaka, that Staka is so result oriented, it creates a monetary obligation besides for the mitzvah component. But it creates a monetary obligation. Im Kain, Mamon Aniim Gabe, who Ki'ilu Chayvim Chov Mamash, it's as if the money is in your hands and you have a debt to the poor. Im Kain. And if that's the case, zesh anu kofin oto, that which we coerce him, hainu lahachzir la'aniye ha'olam mashchayav lahem, is to give back to the poor of the world what you by right owe them. Uvazeh afil matan schar b'tzidam mutal la'beitin lahachzir mashchayav. And that's why you can take it, even though it's a matan schar b'tzidam, because, as Ezra noted, if you steal money, Bezin just takes it. Right? They don't have to coerce you. They just take it. So he says, well, that's staka is more than just a consequentialist mitzvah. It's the result, the fact that the poor have to get your money gives them an actual claim in your property. And therefore, the court doesn't have to ask you. They literally just take it. That's what the Gemara is talking about. Mamaskinen. They just take it from you. But they just take it. That's what we know happens. Uvazav, you'll matan shabbat mutal abedin lahachzir mashal chayav, kevin dinechsohi nishtabdu. Vidavka mitzvah asay, shayim babisham shibu nechsay. A regular mitzvah that doesn't create a monetary obligation, so that we don't coerce. Da'amri, kevin shematan shabbat shidim, in gofen vizenachon vehitev. So that's answer 9. Okay? So let us now summarize. As we saw, 3 types of answers. This isn't real coercion. Rabbeinu Tam, it's verbal coercion. Staka isn't matan schar betzida, either because the schar comes from the emotional component, or because sometimes when it's listed in the Torah, it doesn't have the schar. Or it's an exception. Either it's an exception because there are los assays with it, which either you're forcing the los assays, or you're reinforcing the power of the assays. Or, in this particular case, they agreed, which is Rabbeinu Tam. Or more fundamentally, communal staka is, by definition, coercible, the Rav. Or, staka, yes, it is matan schar betzida, but it's a consequentialist-oriented mitzvah, the Ritva. Or even stronger than that, which is the Ktzot, which is, no, it's more than it's a consequentialist mitzvah in which you have to coerce, because there's still a deontological, virtue, divine command component that we want you to perform the mitzvah. That's not true. Staka is simply, in addition to the mitzvah, there's a chov. There's an actual monetary obligation from the haves to the have-nots, and that is why we can take it away. Just like if you stole an object, we can just extract it from you, so we can extract this property from you. That is 9 answers. And now let me just point out, before Ezra has his question, today we've seen a few very important meta points, right? One is we had, I think, an important conversation about the extent to which mitzvot are consequentialist in nature, divine command, virtue, deontological, and you see that for the Ritva, that's what this depends on. We've seen important questions on the relationship between the emotional components of mitzvot and the masa mitzvah, right? Now the ktzot, if we want to just for a moment look at the broader thing, in sort of modern discourse about the obligations of the haves to the have-nots, you see in the ktzot a very strong language, right? When you hear people saying, look, in the end of the day, it's my money, and I should be able to give it to whoever I want, right? The ktzot is not going to believe that, right? The ktzot, he might say you could give stuff to whoever you want, but the ktzot will really, really believe that not only do you have a moral obligation to support the have-nots, right? But when people say, like, no, the haves, they really, right, they're... part of your money really belongs to the poor at some level. The Ketzot is going in that extreme direction where no one else is, right? No one else went this far, right? Other people said it's consequentialist in nature, but you still have to choose your own volition to give it. There's still a mitzvah commandment. The Ketzot leaves that. He says, no, the way society is structured is that the have-nots actually have a claim against the people who do have. Right? And so you see that Toch Kedei, some of the big questions that are being asked about the nature of ethics, the how much, the extent of the obligations of people who have money to provide for the poor, is it just a moral obligation, right? Or is it more? Is it a monetary obligation? Does it inhere in your property by virtue of the fact that you have, right? These are questions that emerge, right, from it. So if someone wanted to, right, construct a very strong thesis of social welfare, right, the Ketzot is a good place to start, or the Rav maybe is a decent place to start. If you wanted to focus, no, on you have the right to give to whoever you want, and you know, yes, we care about the poor, but we care about you giving it, you know, so then we go in the Shita like Rabbeinu Tam, no. Right? All I can do is encourage you, but you have to do it of your own free will. Right? Staka is about the heart. It's not about the poor being taken, about the heart. Right? These questions are important philosophically, morally, politically. Right? And, right, you sort of, if you pay attention to their language, you realize that the way that these theses can be reflect on or be introduced into modern conversation is actually very significant. Okay, Ezra, take the last word. Go. Say it again? If someone went crazy, yeah.